The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Greetings and welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising podcast. I'm your host, Jay Hursko, and sitting directly across from me is Troy Lightfoot.
Hello, Jay.
And this is the first time I've ever done one in person, so this will be rather interesting. So the topic of this week's episode was, Troy, you made a toss-off comment in a previous episode. I believe it was the Fake Agile podcast we did around Steve Denning,
yes,
where we were talking through, you were having that conversation with, I believe it was Andrew Leff, and you made the remark that when I think about metrics for a successful Agile transformation, I just go back to principles.
Yeah.
And I use the Agile principles as metrics for a successful transformation.
Yeah.
And you and I have been going back and forth this a couple of times because I'm legitimately curious how you do that, because I think that's a novel approach that probably nobody has thought of, or if somebody has, they don't really talk about it.
Yeah.
So if it, what I'd like to do is I'd like to walk through the actual principles.
Okay.
And let's talk however much you can share, right? Yeah. Obviously, because there's client concerns and all that.
Sure.
But I want to talk about, when going through the 12 principles, how you use those to actually derive metrics for a successful transformation. Because I think our listeners will get something out of that, because it's a new way of looking at things, where you're not introducing a framework and reinventing the world. You're basically saying, I have this list of 12. Each one of these things is going to dictate our success, yay or nay.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
So let's just start off with the first one. So the first principle in the manifesto is, our highest priority is to satisfy the customer through early and continuous delivery of valuable software. Mm-hmm. So talk me through this one. How do you turn that into an actual transformation metric?
Well, a lot of people, let me back up for 1 second. A lot of people say, oh, we want to become agile, right? They want to do an agile transformation. So the question is, when we say agile, what do we mean? What are we talking about? That's very generic, and most people, when they say agile, they're just talking about Scrum. Like, let's be honest, right? So, this is a way of getting back to the to quote Alistair, right? To get back to the heart of agile, right? What is agile really about? Well, agile is a set of 4 values and 12 principles. So, if we want to quote unquote be agile, we should measure ourselves against the values and principles. Nothing else, really. And that's the concept behind this.
Okay.
All right. So how do we do this? Well, let's look at the first one. Our highest priority is to satisfy the customer through early and continuous delivery of valuable software. One of the aspects of this principle, when they say customer, I believe they're talking about the clients that they work for, not necessarily end users.
Okay.
So this is, for an example, a lot of the folks who wrote this were consultants. So when they say satisfy the customer, they're not talking about customer satisfaction in the sense of you and I are using Twitter and we're happy with the features.
They're talking about basically the person who's paying the bills. That was the intent.
Yes,
okay.
Because you have two companies, right? One who cannot deliver early and continuously,
mm-hmm,
and it's not focusing on value, right? One who has to deliver in these large waterfall style chunks versus one who's able to deliver at any time and everything they're delivering is valuable, which goes to principle number 10, which is about the art of maximizing the amount of work not done, right? They go hand in hand with number 1 and number 10. So because of that, how might we measure ourselves on that? So it's not a customer satisfaction metric, if you think about it.
Mm-mm.
It's a continuous delivery metric and it's a value metric. So how might you measure continuous delivery? Well, you might measure things like cycle time, lead time, throughput, those types of things. You might also measure business KPIs. So, because you have value, right? So how do we know if something's valuable? We don't actually know until that's validated in the market, right? So we think it's valuable, but the only way we could truly measure that is to use some kind of KPIs. At other clients, I've used something called like feature scorecards.
Okay.
Which every feature has a scorecard, a set of metrics tied back to, did it do what we said it was gonna do, and helps us make pivoting decisions. So how might you use this principle as a metric is looking at the intent behind the principle, which is time to market.
Right. Continuous delivery is that's the term that jumped out at me when I read this one.
Time to market, throughput, and business value, right? So what you could do is you could get with your team, with your organization, with your whatever you do, whatever the context is, break down this principle and saying, have an open discussion. How are we doing at that? Right? What does our cycle time look like? What does our throughput look like? Lead time? What are our business KPIs? What are the outcomes we're measuring? And its outcomes are not a velocity, for example, right?
Right, right.
So this goes to outcomes, and it goes to time to market, and it goes to predictability, because continuous, right? So it's time to market, predictability, and business value. So you would use this as a way to have a conversation. Are we even measuring those three things?
Right, which is where okay. I think a lot of companies, that's probably an eye-opener, because I don't think...
So if we're not, then its question is, well, how do we start? Okay, because right now, if we're not measuring those things, we would say we're basically at a zero because we are the lowest form because we're not even measuring it. So you don't even know where you are until you measure something, right? So I would say start measuring it. Then once you're measuring it, you can have conversations around what do we want our cycle times and throughput to be, right?
Right.
What do we want our business outcomes to look like? And then you start using that to tracking metrics. And then revisit this principle 6 months later, year later, and say, okay, now how are we doing at this principle? This principle as a metric doesn't give you the answer. It gives you the right questions.
Right.
That's
right.
The key.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay. Yeah. So I'm assuming we're uncovering what I think is going to be a theme for the rest of this conversation, is it's not necessarily the principle per se, it's the thought behind it that leads to the conversation that's going to land you in the right place.
Yes.
So let's apply that to number two. So the second principle is welcome changing requirements, even late in development, as your processes harness change for the customer's competitive advantage.
Yes.
So I'm assuming this is more around change absorption, change adoption, how quickly can we pivot, the whole Larman turn on a dime for a dime.
Yes.
How do you use this one?
So again, it all starts with a conversation, obviously. But how do you measure the fact that you can welcome change? So my opinion, and if you're listening out there and you have ideas that are different than this, but it still ties back to the principle, do that. I mean, I'm just giving you some suggestions. Things that would test if you can welcome change. They might be the responsiveness. So that might be measured by lead time. So when a request comes in, right? Some kind of change comes in, but the time it comes in till it's in production, you know, not the time you start working on it, but the time the request itself comes in, that's your lead time, right? That's one metric that you can use for that. Another one is your ability to, when it comes to quality, to not break stuff, right? For an example, you could measure the files with the highest rate of change and look at the unit test coverage around those files. So for example, if you get a lot of requests and you have to go keep changing a certain class or a certain module, right? If that doesn't have any unit test coverage or has very low, it's going to be like performing surgery to make those changes, which means that you are not going to really welcome the change. You're going to be afraid of the change. So that's a type of metric. So you have maybe your CI/CD metrics. You have your leading indicators, which could be unit tests, which could be amount of code that's done in pairs. It could be a lot of different type of leading indicators. And then obviously your lagging, which is escape defects, those types of things. So that's an example of how you could tie some metrics back to the welcome change. And ultimately what you want to do is get back in a room with the folks that you started this with and or with leadership and say, how are we doing at this metric? Because these are what we've chosen to measure. How is that going? Do we need to change something? And just having an open conversation around it.
And I think, back to your point, I think flow efficiency is probably, or lead time, right? Yeah. Lead time is the simplest out of the box indicator. Yeah. If it takes me, and that ties to your remark about unit tests, if it takes me a month of Sundays to deploy something,
yeah,
right? And I know that it's inherently fragile, that month of Sundays going by the book expands,
yes,
due to fear, due to reluctance, due to a whole bunch of a lot of different things. You're not welcoming change in requirements if it's taking you forever to do that.
And you won't be able to welcome change in an environment where my team's building something, some other team has to test it, right? Somebody else has got to deploy it, because then nobody wants to welcome the change, because you want to avoid change in that scenario. Because
yes,
you have dependencies, you have a lot of, you have work that's already in progress that has to be interrupted with three teams instead of one. So that's all part of the metric.
You're introducing fragility. You're introducing change into a system you know is inherently fragile. It gives you pause.
Yes.
So let's go to the third one, Troy. The third one is deliver working software frequently from a couple of weeks to a couple of months with a preference to the shorter time scale.
So this is going to be different for everybody, different context. I know, Jay, you and I were talking earlier about the company you work with and their context, and maybe, you know, delivering a couple times a year might be beneficial, right? For some companies, delivering every day is beneficial. It really is context dependent.
Yes.
And that's why this principle doesn't give a specific, you have to deliver every 2 weeks or every day or something like that. It just says, focus on delivering sooner.
Right.
And that goes back to principle number one, which is early, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily faster, but
early and often.
Right, yeah. Earlier. So because of that, other things you can measure, again, this goes back to the flow metrics, I would say. How do you measure the time? Well, you measure time to market for this one. But it's really about measuring time to market, but having the right conversation around what do we want as a company. It's don't compare ourselves necessarily to Amazon or Google, right? What's better for us?
Okay. Right, so it goes back to context.
Yes.
So, like you alluded to, we were talking about earlier, for a large enterprise organization that's used to 2 deployments a year, say mm-hmm. they do it every 6 months,
mm-hmm.
maybe pushing the envelope for them isn't every 2 weeks. Maybe that's too insane, but is once a quarter.
Right.
Right? But I do think you want to hem on the aggressive side. So shoot a little bit more aggressively, because if you fall short, you're still going to be better than you are.
Right.
So if we do twice a year, let's go to once every other month.
Right.
And see how that works. 6 times a year. Maybe you get to 4. Maybe you get to 5. It's still better than 2.
And the powerful thing about this is the improvements that will come from those conversations and not the metric itself. Because you're going to have a conversation around, we deliver every 6 months. How do we deliver every 2 months? Well, we're going to have to change probably quite a bit about the way we work, maybe our systems, things
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
So these metrics are actionable. That's the key. They are not vanity metrics. They also don't prescribe something out of the box which gives you something easy to do. They require work, but that's why the first value is individuals and interactions over processes and tools. So smart folks who wrote that.
Okay. But that also ties to, like you said, where the key comes out of the actual conversation, mm-hmm. right? It's that old Eisenhower quote where plans are useless, but planning is indispensable.
Yeah.
So if I'm in an organization where we typically deploy once every 6 months,
yeah.
and I say, well, we're going to deploy every month,
right.
the first thing you're going to hear is, well, we can't do that. And then you have to ask why.
Yeah.
And when you say why, they'll go, well, X system has blah, 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 blah. Ah, okay, well, now you've uncovered something you know you need to, like you said, the benefit in the conversation is you can figure out where you need to focus.
Right.
And you don't necessarily need to cure cancer, right, or right. make it perfect,
right.
but something where you know is a log jam or is a choke point, right, is an impediment. Just speaking it out into truth to power,
yes.
now you know where you need to look.
And most people go through these agile transformations with the idea that they want to improve their time to market. Yet they typically don't measure it. So
right.
So there's a quote I love by this woman named Amber Lahern. And she's an ex-software engineer. She kind of transitioned to a different career now. But she has a quote that says, we measure what we believe matters. And I use that quote all the time because I think it's true. So so if we are not measuring time to market, right, then we actually don't believe it matters because we don't measure it, right? If
right.
we really believed it mattered, we'd be measuring. We'd be caring about it. Instead, what things do we typically measure? Well, we measure productivity because that's actually what people believe.
Productivity, and then that ties to resource efficiency.
Yes.
Right? Right.
So what they say, what folks say they want is time to market. But yet what they measure is productivity. Those two things aren't equal. They don't equate at all.
Right.
So think about that when it comes to the metrics. We measure what we believe matters. And if what we're measuring is not what we say we believe, then we actually don't believe it. We need to start believing it.
Right, right.
So there's that.
It ties to that old saying, what gets measured gets managed. What gets managed gets done.
Yes.
So that all that stuff ties together. Start measuring the right things. You'll get the right output.
Yes. Okay.
So going to the next one, Troy. Number 4 is business people and developers must work together daily throughout the project.
Yes. So how would you measure this? Well, I don't know if there's... I guess you could set up some tangible metric. But for me, this is more about sitting in a room with your team, right? This is, to me, this is more of a team level metric. And asking, you know, just having a conversation around... Are the business people, aka usually, it's a product owner, usually, mm-hmm. right? In most, probably 90% of cases, I would say. So 90% of the time in the environment, is the product owner or the product manager, depending on the type of work we're doing, that are we working together every single day? If the answer is no, then how do we get better at that? It's a pretty simple metric.
I also think you'd actually take it. You just said, are we working together every day?
Yeah.
I would actually question, are they working together at all?
Okay.
I have a good friend of mine who's his current transformation he's working on. They're actually running metrics to see for all the teams that they've instantiated, how many have product owners? How many of those product owners come from the business?
Yeah.
How many program, they're a safe shop, so how many program managers, they have product managers. Are they coming from the business? Are they meeting with the stakeholders? So they're trying to make sure that those conversations are happening where it's not just, for lack of a better term, a bunch of IT nerds in a closet talking to one another.
Right.
Right? They are actually talking to their business partner who is using the software they deliver.
Right. So, yeah. So that one's a little more simple, but yeah.
Right, that was an easy one.
Yeah.
Number five. Build projects around motivated individuals, give them the environment and support they need, and trust them to get the job done.
Okay.
So how do you use this? This is one of those touchy-feely type things. How do you use this to define a successful transformation metric?
So motivation is a tricky one, obviously. I don't think you can say, yes, we're motivated or we're not motivated. You see it in the pulse of the team. You see it in the people around you. So if you want to use it as a metric, you could do things like HR surveys, right?
Right, or the typical NPS, employee NPS.
Yes, you can do things like that. I don't know how beneficial they are, but that's a starting point. It's something, right? So that's one thing. Another thing when it comes to the motivation is having a pulse. Let's say you have a team with a scrum master, right? They might do things like put up feedback doors. Let's say you're co-located, for an example, right? You have a feedback door in the area. I don't know if people know what a feedback door is, but basically it's
a Jürgen Appello thing. Yes. Appello, right?
Yeah. Happiness door, feedback door, whatever. And as things are happening, you have people write on sticky notes like, I'm happy about this. I'm pissed about this. Whatever the case is, right? This is I'm just learning something new, and you put it up. And so throughout the sprint or throughout the weeks or whatever you're doing, you'll start seeing these sticky notes populate, right? That's one little, there's many tools and techniques for this stuff. And you can use that data if you go into a retro and say, hey, let's look at a timeline this sprint. What happened on a daily basis? And where were these motivations and are things trending, right? What's causing our most dissatisfaction? Because if people are constantly dissatisfied, if people are constantly running the issues, they're not going to be, eventually their motivation is going to wane. So you can do, this is a lot, I don't want to get into every single tool technique. There's online tools you can use, but that's, the point is to pay attention to it.
Right.
Somehow.
Right. There's things like the Spotify health check, right? Which is the red, yellow, green with the trending up or trending down. I think that's brilliant.
Yeah.
The other thing when I read this, I thought about scaling retrospectives. You have a whole bunch of teams. What is the common thread running through that team? Is it one that they don't feel empowered to get the job done? Yeah. Okay, well now it's not an arithmetic metric. It's almost anecdotal,
right.
But it's a sign that there's a conversation that needs to be had.
Another question I like to ask people is it's around psychological safety, because when it comes to the environment and support they need and trust, right? So one of the questions is, do you feel safe providing leadership honest feedback? If the answer is no, then that metric is failing, simply put. And you ask that anonymously, okay? So you can ask that in a room, you can ask that in an HR survey, or in your own little online survey you build, you can ask a few questions. But one of them is, do you feel safe providing leadership honest feedback, and do you feel safe providing honest feedback to team members? Two different questions. If the leadership one is failing, that means that people feel like they're not trusted, maybe, that they don't have the environment support they need, those kind of questions. That's a simple question, but it can reveal a lot. If you start getting, 30-40% of the team doesn't feel safe to provide someone honest feedback or to escalate things to leadership even, that means they're afraid of what the repercussions are of escalation, which means that the environment is not correct.
It's not safe.
And the support is not there. So that's another type of thing you can do to bring back to that.
Right, and we've had this conversation ad nauseum. A lot of successful change comes down to people feeling comfortable with I hate to use the move fast break stuff analogy because that's terrible on many different levels, but they need to feel comfortable in order to and comfortable and empowered to do something.
Yes,
and that's a big part of it. So number six. Efficient and effective method of conveying information to and within a development team is face-to-face conversation. How do you use this one? So, because let me get set the table, yes. Right? One of my best friends is an agile coach working through a transformation. Mm-hmm. Their organization, they came up with, they called archetypes of different teams.
Yeah.
Archetype A is everyone co-located product owner scrum master team,
mm-hmm.
All the way through to archetype E where everyone is dislocated.
Yeah.
And they have a target metric of what they're calling like a labor blend. Okay. Where we want X percent of our teams to be co-located. We want another percentage to be at least the product of a scrum master co-located. I'll give them credit. They're using it like an experiment.
Yeah.
Right? To say, well, which one of these work better than not?
Okay.
Not necessarily a metric per se, but it's a way of looking at it. How have you seen it done? This is the rare example where I actually had one.
Okay. So the way I would use this as a metric is really, again, analyzing where we're at now. What is our current state of communication? Is it we communicate over email and Slack most of the time? Okay. If the answer is yes, my question would be, let's read the intent of this. Let's try to figure out the intent of this principle number 6. When this was written, there was no such thing as Skype. Okay. So, therefore, you either were in the same room or you were probably emailing each other or having a phone call. So if you think about that context, it's quite clear that compared to a phone call or an email, right, that being in the same room is going to be much better because you have the body language, you have face-to-face, you're probably not going to be multitasking. You could be, but probably not, right? All those types of things. So it is going to be more efficient and effective. So, but in today's world, we all don't work in the same building, okay? So if that's your context, the question is, what might you do to improve where you're at now? So an improvement could be, for some folks, is just turning on your video because you know it's probably available. You're just not using it.
That's a huge one. And you know what? Me personally, prevents me from multitasking if I know you're looking at my face, because you can tell when my eyes are looking off the screen.
So how effective is the meeting going to be if half the people are on the call and half the people are multitasking and no one's on video? You're going to have the meeting. It doesn't mean it's going to be very effective. So I think the intent is the intent of the principle still rings true with video calls. That's my opinion. Now, if we were all in the same room, would that be better? Probably. But that might be unrealistic for different contexts. So at least I would say, what would it take for us to live out the intent behind this principle? Likely it would be focusing on video calls more.
Creating that bond that doesn't come from a dislocated, disassociated voice over a phone.
Yes.
Or we've had multiple conversations. There's all those studies about how nonverbal communication, asynchronous communication like IMs, like emails, are easy to misread.
Yeah.
There's intent, all that sort of stuff. Just, and I preach this from the mountaintops, just turn on the video. Why call when you can write? Why write when you can call? Why call when you can stop by?
Yeah.
If you have the luxury of being co-located, just go around the room and talk to somebody.
Right.
I make a running joke in my current job that if you really want to freak another employee out, call their extension. Because people look at that phone like it's almost like an alien on their desk. Like,
right.
Why is my phone ringing? Like, what is so important that Troy is calling me? And then you call and you ask a question, and you can tell it takes a good 40 seconds for them to calm down and go, oh my God, it's not HR calling me and telling me to get out of the building.
Right.
Right? Because we've, like you said, we've gotten used to Skype, we've gotten used to email and IM. Every effort you can make to do more of a real-time communication where you can sense not only intent but tone, it's a step in the right direction.
Yeah.
And it's weird that we have to train people on this. And we could go off on the rails about the new generations, like the millennials, digital natives.
Right.
How are they dealing with that? Because I guarantee you they're... Why would I pick up the phone?
Yeah.
Like, watch them when the phone rings. It's terrible. What is so important that you need to talk to me now?
Yeah.
Principle number 7. Working software is the primary measure of progress.
Okay. So this could be many different
things. Define, Troy, let's start with you. Define what working software means.
Well, in my opinion, it means that it's working, that it's tested.
Okay.
That it's tested with quality, meaning you're not going to just push out a bunch of stuff that has poor quality, right? For some people, that means zero bugs. Okay. And that's a typical, I would say that's a good approach. Why create problems that you're likely going to have to fix or create new problems in the future, right? But regardless, it is working, meaning the code works for the business result we're trying to achieve. It is tested and it has quality. Okay, so that's the first part. It's got to be working for what we're trying to achieve. It's got to be tested. It's got to have quality. That's part of it. The second part is it working in the sense of, is it working? Is it doing what we thought it was going to do? And that's when the business KPIs and the feature scorecards come into it. Because I think this idea of working, who cares if it has high quality and does what the feature says or the story says if no one uses it or it doesn't actually meet the business outcomes we want. So to me, this goes back to quality metrics, okay? And as well as the amount of things, obviously, you could do, go back to your cycle time through how when things are in production, right? If it's in production and it's tested and it has quality, there's some metrics you can do. You know, DevOps metrics, you can get to that too. So you have your operations metrics about what's working, right?
Mm-hmm.
How much are these things down, or what's the performance of this thing? That you can go into that realm too, right? So I'm not subscribing one particular metric. I'm saying what's working in the context of what you're releasing. Figure that out. And then measure that, essentially, those things. And then it ties back to that. Yeah.
But I also think that word working, there's two types of working. Yeah. There's functionally working. Like you said, that's your testing, your quality. Is it broken? When I hit the button, does it do what I expect the button to do?
Yes.
So there's functionally working, but then there's the intent behind working in the sense of a Mr. Business User, right? They don't care what your Sonar Cube report says.
Right.
They do, but they don't. Right. They really care that it's helping me accomplish what I need to do.
Yes.
So you could deliver a 100% functional, reliable piece of code that does jack for the business. So that maybe is not working. That's functional, but it's not working.
I agree.
And I think it ties to, let's define as a transformation, you should define what working means together.
Yes.
Because again, you and I could churn out Java code hand over fist, but if it doesn't do what the business wants, or it doesn't help satisfy a hypothesis or try to prove or disprove something.
Right.
What did I just build?
And if it has poor quality and it creates a bunch of new work or rework, is it really working? I would argue no.
Right. Number 8, agile processes promote sustainable development. The sponsors, developers, and users should be able to maintain a constant pace indefinitely.
So this goes back to a few things. One is about sustainable pace regarding the people doing the work. So you could do things like, how many hours are people working every week, right? If you notice a pattern that people are logging 50, 60 hours a week, right?
Then that hero fire up firefighter culture,
right?
That's burnout right there.
So that could be a metric you could use, right? Another metric is, you know, maybe the going back to the lagging indicators, which are ENPS, the more the HR side. There's part of that. The next part of the principle, though, is sponsors, developers, and users. So this goes back to should be able to maintain a constant pace indefinitely. So to me, this goes back to not two parts, not creating technical debt, because the more technical debt you create, the less sustainable it's going to be indefinitely, right? You're going to have, again, going back to the last principle I just mentioned about working. The last part about this is talking to the people that are using this thing, because you're going to say, hey, we do continuous deployment. Every week we push out like 2 or 3 new features or a couple stories a week or whatever, right? It's out in production. People are using it. We're the best team, right? Yet, people are just getting the stuff, but they're not using it. Because one, they might not know how to use it. Two, they might not even know it was released, right? Three, it might be too much change for them. So, So you have to understand who your end users are. Is it too much change? If it's too much change, maybe we need to back off how much we're turning on.
Yes. Right?
Number two is we can't just turn a bunch of stuff on if people, one, aren't aware that it exists, or we could if we were just doing some behind-the-scenes testing maybe. Or three is maybe there's some element of releases of marketing needed for this to be sustainable. Maybe there's some element of education, right? Maybe there's some element of, you know, all these things instead of just saying, hey, our cycle times and throughputs and all this, we're killing it. Meanwhile, the users aren't using it. Or they don't even know it exists, or they don't know how to use it. So it's a combination of user experience, or I think this is combining user experience into it. And when I say user experience, I'm not talking about UI. I'm talking about the actual experience of using a product. Is it frustrating for any reason, right?
Right.
Those types of things. So I think it's a combination of people doing the work and not getting burned out, and also the people that are actually using whatever you're doing is it sustainable long term for this perspective?
Right? The thing that jumps out at me is, so constant pace, your first thought is flow, right? Yeah. And all the Reinertsen stuff comes out. Yeah. Cycle time, throughput, whip, all that. Yeah. So, but for me, it jumps out about sponsors being included in this principle, right?
Right.
Because you think about it, technology always gets a decent budget in every company I've ever worked at, right? We get a whole lot of money, a whole lot of shovels thrown at the hole to dig it faster,
yeah.
right? But like you said, maybe there is a problem with the change succeeds or fails based upon the organizational elasticity, how much it can actually absorb.
Right.
So you're right. What good is pushing code every 2 weeks right. behind feature toggles, right?
Right.
If there's a constraint on the other side where the business people can't even get their head wrapped around it because you're going too fast.
Right.
So now you've exposed a different problem,
right.
right? Is the problem that we're deploying too much, or is the problem that maybe they need more help?
Right.
Or maybe we should, like we talked about, you know, maybe 2 weeks is, don't shoot for every 2 weeks.
Right.
Maybe once a month is better suited for that.
Right.
So again, I think it ties a lot to the conversation. But the fact that sponsors are brought up in this for me is the one that it rattled around my head, because there is an organizational impact to the things that we do, and you need to think outside of just the teams and trains and solutions, but the greater organization as a whole.
Right.
Because there is change absorption there. And that needs to be looked at too. You can't turn a blind eye to it and say,
right.
well, the business needs to catch up.
Right. Exactly. So this one to me is about going up. Well, part one is understanding your own burnout, your own capacity for not getting burnt out. Number two is actually talking to your sponsors and the end users before you do these releases, after you do them, understanding how is it impacting them. Is this a sustainable pace for them? What do they need? You know, those types of things. And then a lot of times marketing could come into play too.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So. There are certain aspects of the business that agility may not be the solution for them.
Right.
And there are some things where I used to do credit cards
yeah.
where there was a longer lead time because you needed to get the creatives done, the marketing, you needed
yeah.
to print the actual plastic.
Yeah.
Sometimes you do need that window.
Right.
And every 2 week deployments may not be the best interest there
right.
because you're to use a tried sport analogy, you're outkicking your coverage.
Yes. 100%.
And that'll probably be the first and last sports reference I use on this podcast.
Okay.
Number nine, continuous attention to technical excellence and good design enhances agility.
So this to me is a combination of leading and lagging indicators regarding not only quality, but flexibility and scalability of a system. So the first thing that jumps to my head are the solid principles. So for those who aren't aware, solid principles were coined by Robert Martin. He didn't invent them, but he basically coined them as kind of the big five object-oriented design principles. And the reason for those principles is to enhance agility, meaning for the ability to be able to welcome change, to be able to pivot, to be able to add changes to a system without breaking anything, without making it fragile, without making it rigid, right? Unchangeable. And so this goes back to our... So if you look at number nine, it says, obviously people focus on... A lot of times people read these principles and they just focus on the first few words. For example, continuous attention to technical excellence. So they just say, oh, we just got to have good quality. No, it's saying, there's that, right? And good design.
Mm-hmm.
Don't leave that out, because it's not talking about UI design, it's talking about your system design, it's talking about the overall architecture of it, things
right.
like that.
You can have great design principles, but right. if you haven't architected the correct solution, that will scale.
Right.
What's the quote you use, I beat this thing to death, when you try and scale garbage on top of garbage, you end up with a landfill?
Yeah, you scale garbage, you get
a landfill. Garbage, you get a landfill.
Yeah.
Right? You're right, don't concentrate on the first half. It needs to be built on a solid foundation.
Yeah.
Because if not, you're going to just...
And
building on sand.
And those conversations, when we get to principle number 11, I'm going to save this next part for 11, because I'll have nothing for 11 if I say the next part. So let's move on.
I think of Jorgen Hesselberg and his, you know, are we building the right thing? Are we building the thing right at the right speed? And
yeah.
that ties to like typical DevOps metrics, which is stuff like mean time to resolve, it's escape
right.
defects,
yeah.
Code density, code coverage, all those things. That stuff out the box that if you're following XP and technical practices, you should be doing anyway.
Right.
That's almost a shoo-in,
right.
I would think.
Yeah.
So number 10. This is how I approach my love life, and it's probably the way it is. Simplicity, the art of maximizing the amount of work not done, is essential.
Right. So a lot of people measure productivity. This is almost the opposite in the sense of, can we measure how much stuff we're throwing out? So one of the ways you can do that is if you have a backlog of ideas, right? Imagine you were doing it in a physical... Let's take away the digital tools for a second, okay? And we were going to do everything on a big wall, okay? And we're going to put sticky notes and everything.
Which arguably is the easiest way to learn Agile, but we'll that's another episode.
And underneath that wall, we had a trash can, okay? How many of the sticky notes that were once on the wall are in the trash can? Okay? That's a simplistic way to look at this because most people don't think that's a good thing. They think if it's in Jira, that it's got to get built, a lot of people, right? Oh, it's in Jira. And then it's like, it's been in Jira for 8 months. Okay? Like, is it even worth building? Should it go in the trash can? Oh, well, there's a lot of people who just get scared of deleting things or closing things out for some reason, right? Oh, maybe we're going to need that in the future. There's a term that comes from the XP folks, I believe, and it's called Yagni. It says you aren't going to need it. And it actually comes from a development practice when it comes to people gold-plating stories and features and things like that. But it's still, to me, the concept rings true is if it's been in Jira for 6 months and it's not prioritized right now, maybe throw it in the trash.
That ties to the whole there's the no backlogs movement. Yes. There's the zero defect movement. Where I had a very heated conversation with a couple people in my current job where I said, if it's not important enough to fix right now, why do we need to keep track of it? Because that ties to the Reinertsen stuff around the effort to maintain a queue eventually becomes counterproductive and you're spending so much time maintaining this backlog that you're not getting any value out of that.
Yes.
Right? That's almost that you consider it by the traditional sense, the lean definition, it's almost waste.
Yes.
Because if you amplify it three times, it doesn't provide three times the value. So what am I doing?
Yes.
That's one of the things I think this is also the think about how many times do you come up with an MVP, something you've defined as minimum viable, or what is the shortest way to prove this hypothesis right or wrong? That's really how you look at it. I do like your idea of a trash can though, where we fill with Post-its. I wonder how that would go over, because that's challenging a traditional paradigm.
So,
right?
So I have done this at clients, particularly my last client. We set up discovery Kanban. And this is done at a portfolio level, and we had a lot of big ideas, and the goal of the discovery Kanban team was to throw things in the trash. It wasn't just to validate stuff to build it. It was how much are we throwing out? Because if we can validate things or invalidate things to put them in the trash, that has saved us an insane amount of time and money in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that the concept is that, you know, this was a safe context. So they had an Agile release train, right? Which is 8 teams per train on average. So the amount of money it costs to have a train build something, right? Versus to have a cross-functional discovery team who's working on this stuff ahead of time, these initiatives, and doing the problem validation. Are we even solving the right problem?
Right, right.
And solution validation, ahead of time. And then so every 10 ideas, we want to be throwing, you know, there's no number really. But if there are 10 ideas, there's no way that all 10 are worthy really of bringing to the art. Because likely most people, our assumptions are wrong about a lot of things. Mm-hmm. That's why the whole 80-20 rule, right? They say like 80% of the features are not used or barely used, right?
Right.
That's because most of the time assumptions are wrong. So this number 10 gets to the mindset and the mantra of what can we throw out? Let's always be looking for what throw out, what not to do.
Right. I'm sure you and I I know I've got the experience, especially coming from waterfall shops, where I've been part of projects that spent millions to do something, to validate an idea, 18 months of development, to put it into prod, and it either doesn't give us the results that we even remotely thought, or it ends up shifting, it ends up being built on sand because we were trying to hit the old triple constraint, time, cost, quality.
Yeah.
We ended up, we ended up turning it off.
Right.
So that was like, well, what did I spend that? What did I lose again all that stress for?
Right. And that's the point of feature scorecards as well, is it's not about that one feature per se. That feature, when I say feature in the context of this, I'm talking about a giant user story, right? Like what they would call a Jira epic or something. Is that that feature was put in production with the assumption that we would get some kind of business outcomes for it, right? But the scorecard is to tell us about what to do in the future, not necessarily about that feature. Because we had an assumption about that feature, we were going to get something, some assumption. If our assumption was wrong, what else are we wrong about related to these other features, right? And that helps us throw things out. So the feature scorecard, yes, is a lagging indicator, but it's a lagging indicator that you can use for a leading indicator for future work, with the idea that we will throw things out if this thing is didn't meet our assumption, because we have to ask ourselves why. And what other things are our backlog which we're probably wrong about because we were wrong about this one? Mm-hmm. So it's having those conversations, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Number 11.
Yeah.
The best architectures, requirements, and designs emerge from self-organizing teams.
Okay.
So talk me through setting up a metric here, because based upon the remark you made before about most people get hung up on the first couple words,
yes.
I can see someone looking at this and saying, well, this is all about architecture, requirements, designs. Like, how do we do that better? And then the second half is, well, the self-organizing team piece gets almost thrown out baby with the bathwater.
Yes. So how much of the stories are written or refined by the team? Or are they handed to by someone from the business? Right?
Mm-hmm.
Because if a team is a story factory, okay, and they're just being handed something and they go build it, that is not this principle.
Right.
This principle
is... I think that'll cause way more problems later on.
Right. Right. So this story is saying that the teams themselves write the stories. Not they have to write every single story, but they're involved in the story writing. They're involved in the actual refining of the story, right? The creation of it, as well as the architecture. So does that mean that you don't have anyone in an enterprise who's looking at the high-level architecture systems? No, it just means that the people doing the work are the ones responsible for the low-level architecture, and that goes to the things like the solid principles, right?
Right.
The classes, they're the ones doing that stuff. No, it's not someone else is sitting and saying, your classes are going to be designed this way based off this UML diagram.
Which is a typical, which is a typical way that a lot of large enterprises work.
Right.
You know, these architects, right? Not to speak ill of the architect, because I've met some great ones, they are almost treated as they're like this star chamber where this massive Visio comes down from the top of the mountain.
Right.
And like you said, I'm just a feature factor. We just go build.
Right.
Yeah. That will create problems later on.
So that is what this principle is trying to avoid, is that situation. So how would you measure that? Well, simply put, I would just ask ourselves, let's say you're doing Scrum, right? Out of the last four sprints, how many of the stories we work on did we actually either write or have a part in writing or refining, right?
Mm-hmm.
If the answer is like 10%, then how do we get better at that, right?
Right,
that's one example. The other one is the same thing for architecture, right?
Mm-hmm.
Were we just given this whole thing and just go build it? Or did, when we were developing it as a team, were we having input on what the architecture should be? Were we doing some kind of emergent architecture through like test-driven development where the architecture actually emerges through the tests, right? And through the refactoring.
Right.
Those kinds of things. So you can measure amount of code that's being done in test-driven development. Because if you're doing test-driven development actually by the book, the architecture will emerge through there. Mm-hmm. So I kind of look at it as in an enterprise, you have someone that's thinking about the enterprise architecture, which is not the same thing as the low-level architecture of every class.
Right. And I actually think we need to have another conversation about the role of enterprise architects in an agile space.
Okay.
Because I'm starting to think about, we were talking about previously, I do a lot of reading about Dave Snowden. Like I'm a big Snowdenite, right? And Kinefin and Complexity, where he talks a lot about don't go in with a goal, especially in a complex system, in a complex adaptive system. Yeah. Go in with a direction. Yeah. We want to go this way. And I think that's where, not to bury the lead for the next episode, but that's where I think that enterprise architecture discussion needs to go, is come up with a general direction and let the teams, like you said, emerge through testing, figure out the right way to build it.
Right.
And it also ties to, when I looked at this one, the first thing I think of is empowerment.
Yeah.
And the interview we did with Dan Mezick, where he talks about truly successful agile organizations are ones that have lowered the decision-making floor to the level where the teams that are making this, the level that's making the decisions are the ones, is the level that has to live with said decision.
Yeah.
Like you said, is it coming down from the top? Or is it you and I sitting there spitballing through testing, trying to figure out the best way to make it work?
Right.
9 times out of 10, that will end up with better results than someone who's 2 or 3 steps abstracted and can't get back to that.
And it goes back to centralized versus decentralized decision making. So, for example, decisions that should be decentralized, going back to this principle, right? I'm thinking are decisions that have to, that might happen often or change repeatedly, right? That have to make a lot of decisions. that are short-lived, for example, like classes, like things like that, right? Testing, because that stuff, as new requests come in, new stories come in, they're going to be impacting those classes and the tests, and so the team should be making all those decisions because they're the ones doing it. Things that are going to be very long-lived decisions, which might be some kind of enterprise integration with hardware, that it's really difficult to change that decision. Mm-hmm. To me, that should be like a centralized, and that's where like an enterprise architect has a very, very important role for centralized decisions, mm-hmm. right? Versus decentralized team-level decisions, if that makes any sense.
No, it does make sense. Okay. It does. So taking us to the last principle, number 12, at regular intervals, the team reflects on how to become more effective, then tunes and adjusts its behavior accordingly.
So my favorite metric for this one is results. I'll put it this way. Hypothesis-driven retros. There's a couple of metrics you can use, but one I like is I like this concept of empiricism. So if we're in a retro and we come up with an idea which we think is going to improve our team, right, or our system or whatever the case is, how do we know that that has happened? Well, because again, it's just an assumption if we do X, we're going to get Y, right? We need to come up with a set of leading indicators which we can test week after week to determine if that's happening or not. For example, if we say, if we're a team that never pair programs, right? And we say, hey, if we start pair programming, we think we're going to increase our quality by, I don't know, let's say every release we're going to do, we're going to have 50% less escape defects, right? Just making numbers up. Okay, then our hypothesis is if we pair on half the stories, we're going to get half the defects. I'm just simplifying things, okay? Well, then we need to measure that and look at the amount of pairing we're doing, because we said half of it. So every sprint we should be saying, did we pair on half the stories? Yes or no? Because that's a leading indicator to what we think our lagging indicator is, right? Which is the escape defects. And then as our release, if the defects are coming and we need to be measuring that, and then at our retros, we'll look at our hypothesis and saying, is this validated or invalidated? If it's validated, meaning yes, we got the results we wanted, now what do we do? Is 50% less defects, is that where we want to be? Or do we want to be 80% or 100%, whatever the case is, right? So maybe we need to do more pairing or more mobbing or some other thing or whatever, right? So that is one thing. Or something as simple as, hey, if we changed the amount of times we integrate per week or per day or whatever the case is, we're going to get X benefits. That's something we can measure quickly because we're going to be integrating maybe daily or something like that. Mm-hmm. So we can measure that day over day and sprint over sprint. So any kind of decision made by the team like this, if we think it's going to get some kind of benefit, we should be eating our own dog food in the sense of we talk about empirical process. We talk about doing this on a product level. We should be doing it on a process too. So I think you can use that type of things for metrics. That's one. And as well as, are we only doing this at a retrospective? Or has this become part of our culture where we talk about how to improve?
Right, right.
And that is something like, hey, we're at a daily scrum or daily stand-up, and are we just getting around and saying, yesterday I did A, and tomorrow I'm doing B, or today I'm doing B, and I got no blockers, and everyone's going to roll around. And then we just leave, and we go back to work, and we put our headphones on, and, you know, I'll see you tomorrow, right? Or are we actually acting as a team and planning for the day? And part of our plan is, hey, we are not on track for meeting our sprint goal, which we told each other we think we can accomplish, right? What do we have to change? How do we inspect and adapt today to be able to meet our plan? What do we have to do differently? Right? And that's essentially, it's not a retrospective, but it's a mini, mini retrospective. It's right. One question.
It's just a healthy conversation.
For today, yeah. Right? Okay. Yeah. For today and tomorrow, maybe. So that's an example of, is that part of our culture? I'm just giving an example. I'm not saying you have to do that every day, but I'm saying, is that part of our culture that we're always thinking about how to improve? Or is it just
happening? Are we going through the motions?
Right. Yeah. That's the question.
Yeah. I think one of the things I've seen, especially with enterprises that try to stand up a whole slew of teams, is the simple question of, are you doing a retro? Yes or no? Are you doing a retro at the end of iteration? Yes or no? It sounds like such a simple thing.
Yeah.
But my experience has shown me that a lot of teams won't. Yeah. And that's a precursor to a problem.
Yeah.
And then the question of when you have, 90% of respondents are saying that, okay, we are doing retros. Okay, well, what are the changes? The question of what are the changes that what are the things you've done? Yeah. What changes have you introduced to your working environment as a result of those retros? That's another good conversation. Mm-hmm. Simultaneously, the question of if you're in a safe shop, you know, are your RTEs scaling retrospectives? Yes. Are the solution engineers scaling the RTE? Are these conversations actually happening? That's the first thing. And then the second thing is, what action is coming out of those conversations? Because if you just do the conversations and don't result in actions, you're just killing time, basically.
Yes. Yeah. So that goes to the hypothesis testing and actually putting metrics to test whether or not you're doing these things or that are getting the results you want.
Okay. All right. Well, Troy, thank you very much. This has been an interesting conversation for me. It definitely sends me back arm for bear, hopefully, for the listeners. I hope you've gotten as much out of it as I have. Again, this was a toss-off comment. I never thought we'd turn this into an episode. On behalf of Troy and myself, I want to thank everybody for listening. On behalf of the listeners, Troy, I want to thank you for taking the time this wonderful Saturday morning. Thank God it's not 90 degrees outside.
Yeah.
There will be a thread on the Coalition posted about this podcast. So if you have your own ideas, if you want to continue the conversation, please join us at coalition.agileuprising.com. If you're interested in more lifetime conversation, our Discord server has really seen a massive uptick in traffic. Mm-hmm. For an example, earlier this week, I got into a long conversation of how does a Agile practitioner define their toolkit, which I thought was an almost philosophical, hypothetical question, which it took us down an interesting rabbit hole.
Right.
So if you're interested in more lifetime conversation, join us there. Otherwise, I want to thank everybody. You can find us on every podcast platform of choice. If you like what you hear, please give us a review on iTunes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There is a Patreon out there if you feel like... if you feel like contributing again, we are 100% free and will continue to be so. Any final words, Troy, before I wrap setting this home?
No, just hope everyone has a great week.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody. This is the Agile Uprising Podcast signing out. Until next time.